From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Churches historically have played a leadership role in the Black community. We talk about how faith groups in Baltimore are engaging in the digital and decentralized Black Lives Matter movement. Then Tom Hall talks to Rabbi Daniel Kotzenberg from Beth Am Congregation and the Reverend Andrew Foster Connors from Brown Memorial Church about what they're doing to make their congregations more inclusive. Plus, Tom and theater critic Jaywin Russick discuss the Jazz Age musical Thoroughly Modern Millie at Cockpit and Court Theater of the Community College of Baltimore County. And we talked to two grad students who just won a prize for their proposal that Baltimore make healthy produce more accessible by setting up a market that would charge cheap prices for food otherwise headed for the landfill. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Churches in the Black community historically have been a vital institution, a central force of social change. From Martin Luther King Jr. to the Reverends Fred Shuttlesworth, Richard Boone, Pauli Murray, myriad church leaders helped birth the modern civil rights movements. Fast forward to 2015 in Baltimore. On the day of Freddie Gray's funeral and the night of the unrest, scores of Black clergy walked down North Avenue to quell the unrest. And it raises the question, as the Black Lives Matter movement has grown, a decentralized group of community leaders, activists, authors, journalists, and students using digital tools like Twitter, how has the Black faith community in Baltimore engaged with this growing group? Joining us by phone on his way back to Baltimore from a national Black Lives Matter conference in Cleveland, Ohio, is Jamie Wooten. He works on digital strategies, particularly for faith groups, and is a fellow at Boston University School of Theology's Social Justice Institute. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And with us in the studio is Reverend Todd Urey, senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church. He's also an adjunct professor in the College of Public Affairs at the University of Baltimore and past political action chair for the Maryland State Conference NAACP. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Jamie Wooten, you're fresh from the inaugural Movement for Black Lives Conference. Tell us a bit about it. What is your big takeaway from the experience this weekend?
Well, it was a national convening of about 1,000 organizers, activists, scholars, and clergy. The great takeaway is this growing movement of sort of decentralized leadership, right, as they call leaderful, right? So recognizing all of these various organizers, all of these leaders across the country, and how do we move in a sort of a new way. We're used to sort of a more messianic, more top-down leadership model. Now you see as a decentralization of communications via social media, we're starting to see a decentralized movement as far as organizing. So it was great to see this strong attempt to bring various voices to the table and all of them to have a voice.
Pastor Urey, in the last 2 years since the start of Black Lives Matter, so much focus has been on the work of digital coalitions and groups. How has the work of Black churches and other religious institutions changed since the Freddie Gray experience?
I'm not sure how much it's changed since Freddie Gray. I think it's been an expansion of how we reach out and communicate our willingness to participate, our desire to participate in the multiple conversations that are going on right now about how we heal our city. And so the digital movement for a church that has been very localized and centralized has caused us to expand not only how we think about our message, but who we're reaching out to. These may not necessarily be members in our pews, but these are folks who really have an interest in terms of what does the institution that we've come to know as the Black Church, how is it speaking out and participating in the conversation around social justice in the 21st century?
And what about the point that Jamie Wooten made about this being decentralized, not messianic, not top-down, an echo of Ella Baker, as Jamie Wooten has written, a civil rights leader who was very key in many civil rights movements, but sort of behind the scenes at a time when Martin Luther King Jr. was much more up front. How does that sit with those of you in the traditional Black church?
Well, when we talk about the traditional church and when we really tell the truth about the civil rights movement, the messianism of Martin Luther King happened after he died. That when he was first pulled into the bus boycott in Montgomery, it was almost by default. No one else wanted to be the quote-unquote leader. He was kind of put into the role to kind of help organize this new kind of approach to dealing with the justice issues of the day. So I'm not sure it's an issue of messianic kind of desire. I think it's often critiqued that way. But when you look at what the church historically does, most of what the church does is behind the scenes and not one where there's some person that wants to be lifted up. The problem with the 21st century is that the media has hyped, I think, an unfair impression of the church as a whole. And there are many churches of various sizes where there's not necessarily this drive, where the leaders of the church, the pastor, because of the structure of the church, is engaged in conversations with a number of groups to see how does the church find its niche, find its fit in the broader conversation about what's going on in the community.
Jamie Wooten, I want to pull you back in here. Your work involves consulting with faith-based groups on strategy, public policy, organizing. How have Black churches been part of the recent digital organizing work taking place in Baltimore?
Taking place in Baltimore, I think some of the ways that we have used it in Baltimore was the days that the schools were closed to reach out via social media around Baltimore Lunch. So there was a hashtag created, Baltimore Lunch. We reached out locally as well as nationally to use social media to organize churches who opened up to feed, to do lunch, breakfast, as well as dinner. So we see people using hashtags, organizing around hashtags to come together and pull resources.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Jamie Wooten, social entrepreneur and digital strategist based in Baltimore, and Reverend Todd Yeary, senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church and adjunct professor in the College of Public Affairs at the University of Baltimore. Pastor Yeary, how do you think the new and younger audiences that Black Lives Matter has helped pull together, how are they connected to older institutions and groups?
Well, they tend not to be as connected to older institutions, which is one of their particular strengths. I appreciate what's going on in the moment because it takes us out of this dichotomous assumption that it has to be either or. Actually, the justice call of the day requires a both and. You need the anchor of the historic institutions that have an appreciation for what movements mean, what movements can accomplish, albeit in a different way. So my older congregation, they don't know much about hashtags, but they know a whole lot about marching. They know a whole lot about the justice call, and they can make themselves available in different ways. The 21st century generation of my children, my oldest children, 20 and 19, they communicate a little differently. Their method of protest is slightly different, but the message of justice is where we find some continuity. And so if we recognize that there are going to be multiple levels, multiple approaches to engage in the process, there's room in this kind of a struggle because it is literally life and death where everybody can participate in their own way. The key is, are all voices being heard?
Jamie, let me take that to you and let me ask you. I was so struck by what I've read that you've said about Ella Baker that I sort of summarized what I think your point is. But of course, here we have you and you should make it yourself. Do you find that faith groups working on racial justice have this model of decentralized decision making, the both and that Reverend Yeary just talked about?
No. I mean, I think Ella Baker was very critical of King as well, right? So she was critical of saying, you know, strong people don't need strong leaders. So she pushed for this more participatory model where all voices were being heard. And so I think that I know of a conference coming up at the end of the year around young millennial clergy who are activists. And I'm very curious of how young millennials within the structure of the church, which is of hierarchical structure, how they will begin to organize young millennials within this structure. I'm seeing some young millennials who have stepped out, created digital platforms, and are navigating these spaces quite well. And I think this is the church of the future. Dr. Fred Smith from Wesley Theological used to talk about pastors of the future will be great facilitators. And I think that this sort of decentralized model creates space for all voices to be heard. I think that this movement will shift the church to really grapple with all voices being heard, really being a part of the movement.
Reverend Urey, how does that sound to you?
It sounds good that all voices need to be heard. I think here's where we have to wrestle with what are we producing as far as outcomes? Because in the deeper conversation around how we actually get policy change accomplished, that is actually in more of the face-to-face interactions where you're trying to push legislators to make some serious decisions about how they alter what has become the trend in social justice and law, right? So it's slightly different. So you galvanize people to create momentum, but then there has to be some conversation about how you get to legislation. And I don't think that piece has been particularly clear in terms of the organic movement, the decentralized movement, because when you look at the process of legislation and policy, as much as social media has changed, that structure, that process has not changed. And so the question becomes, even inside that movement, when there's outreach from within the structure to see who's going to have a conversation about what needs to be done specifically, how do we get to the legislation, that's not going to leave room for everybody to be heard. At some point, there's going to have to be a designee, albeit maybe not a quote-unquote leader, that's going to have to communicate what are the points we're asking for, what are the things that we're looking for, because when you look at the structures in Annapolis and in other places, that's not decentralized. That's highly structured and in many cases very rigid. And so there's going to be this uncomfortable place of if there's going to be full participation in this process, who's going to do the speaking even in a decentralized framework?
We have just a minute left. Jamie Wooten, and I'd like you to address that. I was struck with NPR's report on the Cleveland convening that you participated in this weekend. They stressed the delight that so many of the people there felt in actually seeing physically the people they had been tweeting with. Mm-hmm. So is it important to hang on to the centralized, the physical, the old ways?
I think it's both. And I'm not suggesting that you throw them away. I mean, and I think this is a new movement. I say that, you know, could the hashtag be leading us to this Ella Baker movement? And I'm saying that if it is, that the hashtag must have an ideological framework, right, so that we move away from what I call reactivism. So I agree with Pastor Urey. Like, at the end of the day, we do have to have policy. We do have to have spokespersons. And I think that ideological framework is part of what has to be developed, even around Black Lives Matter, to say, what is the agenda? What does it mean, Black Lives Matter? What does the hashtag mean? And begin to build movement under this hashtag or ideology being the glue that holds decentralized movements together.
What do you think happens next?
I think people continue to move. I think that young people are extremely excited, right? So they will continue to move under this decentralized banner. Twitter, social media has opened up opportunities for various voices. I think people will continue to build. They will continue to critique themselves. There's a lot of critique within inside of the movement. So it's not one movement, right? There's a lot of ideologies, a lot of critique. And I think that people will continue to tweak this out as we march towards justice.
Well, I appreciate you both giving us at least some insight into this. It's obviously a lot more to think about. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Jamie Wooten is a social entrepreneur and digital strategist, a fellow at Boston University School of Theology Social Justice Institute. Reverend Todd Urey is a senior pastor of the Douglas Memorial Community Church and an adjunct professor in the College of Public Affairs at the University of Baltimore. We have more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on the show, another aspect of churches connecting to community in a changing world. Stay with us for that.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Hey, good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, and now it's time for Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Today, a conversation about inclusiveness in faith congregations. What does it mean for a place of worship to be open and welcoming? We'll examine that not just from a theological perspective, but also in light of the murders at a church in Charleston this year or shootings at mosques and synagogues in recent years. We'll look at the tensions that faith institutions face between openness and basic security in their buildings. Organized religion has more than a few reasons to feel insecure. A report about the changing landscape of religion in the United States, released a couple of months ago by the Pew Research Center, found that the number of Americans who describe themselves as unaffiliated with any religion has jumped nearly 7% in the last 7 years. My guests this morning are the dynamic leaders of two congregations in Baltimore that are bucking that trend and who have increased their membership in recent years. Rabbi Daniel Katzenberg has been the rabbi of Beth Am Congregation in Reservoir Hill since 2010. Reverend Andrew Foster Connors is the senior pastor at Brown Memorial Park Avenue Presbyterian Church, a position that he has held for the past 11 years. Good morning to you both. Good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
So, Andrew, let's talk a little bit about security. You guys are both, full disclosure, you guys are both my neighbors. Daniel, you and I live next door to each other, so I share a kitchen wall with you. And Andrew, the offices of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society have been housed in the office building of Brown Memorial Church for 34 years,
so right.
I share an office wall with you.
That's right. I can hear it when you put things away in your closet.
There you go. And I've got many things in my closet, which we'll talk about at a different time. But, you know, in light of the murders in Charleston, in light of, Nathan just telling us a report about an attack at a prayer service in Frederick, literally opening the building is a difficult, complicated matter. Obviously, people come to the church, they come to Brown Memorial looking for the minister, looking for help, looking for counseling, looking for, you know, all sorts of things. But it's not just an easy call to just open the door. And talk about some of the issues that you faced in the building that affects all of us.
Sure. Around. Well, thanks for having us on today, Tom. I think that, as Christians, we're called to be an open community, to have our doors open and to meet anybody who comes through those doors. And at the same time, as you recognize, there have been incidents. We've actually had an incident ourselves in our building. So we have to kind of balance the need for people to be safe, but at the same time, recognize that the Christian community, safety isn't at the top of the list. Hospitality really is at the top of the list. And so we have to take on that risk as a part of our faith and walk together through the vulnerability that hospitality entails.
Yeah, of course, we had a guy come to the church, enter the building, be threatening to people on the staff. I mean, this is a real thing that happened right here in Baltimore. The Department of Homeland Security actually offers grants to congregations to upgrade their security. And there have been 970 recorded episodes of violence in the last 15 years in places of worship. So it's a complicated issue, isn't it? And something that happens all across the country.
Well, it's a complicated issue, but I also think that, from a faith perspective, we have to be careful within the Christian community about getting too obsessed with security and with fear. A big part of the message of the gospel is do not fear. A part of that is being reminded of who it is and what it is that saves us. And I think that when the Christian community, when we remind each other of that truth, then we walk fearlessly through some of these challenges, even when it puts us at risk, so that together we can continue to bear that message of fearlessness that is, I think, part of the joy of the gospel.
And Rabbi Daniel Katzenberg, at Beth Am, you've all just had a very historic vote talking about inclusiveness, and this involves people who are not Jewish, interfaith families, and their status as members. Tell us about what that issue was and how it was decided by your congregation.
Yeah, that's right. We've just been through a really important process, I think, in the history of the congregation, where at the end of a series of conversations and ultimately a vote by the entire congregation on the bylaws of the synagogue, we decided to welcome interfaith families and couples as full member families at Beth Am.
And is this unusual for conservative congregations? Yours is a conservative congregation as opposed to a Reform or Orthodox, et cetera. Is this unusual nationally and locally here in Maryland?
Yeah, it is true. We're a conservative congregation, though I would say we're conservative to a point. We were unaffiliated for most of our existence. So part of this is about how we assess ourselves as a conservative shul. But a lot of this is how do we think of ourselves as a traditionally minded but also progressive, open congregation in general. This is something that I think is being addressed by conservative synagogues and other non-Orthodox synagogues around the country. Is how do we reconcile with the real demographic trends that exist and also really respond to individuals and couples and families who come to our doors and want to cast their lot with a synagogue, with the Jewish people?
The Pew poll that just came out in May said that more people are switching religions than ever before. More than 42% of folks who do affiliate have a different religion than they did in childhood. Andrew Foster Connors, you've been very involved with BILD, the Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. Your organization called for the resignation of Anthony Batts, who was subsequently dismissed by the mayor. You've also called for the resignation of Gregory Thornton, the head of the city schools. You're politically involved as a minister. You lead a congregation. You're leading a group of socially active people. Daniel Katzenberg also been involved in a lot of social justice stuff. What happens when you espouse views in the political realm that are not consistent with some of the views of your congregants?
Well, let me just clarify. We did call for the resignation of Commissioner Batts. We did not call for the resignation of Dr. Thornton. We simply said that we believed he had lost some of the momentum that many of us had generated. So I do want to make that important distinction.
Thank you for that clarification.
I think the whole philosophy behind BILD is that the community is stronger when we're together. And a lot of our work, actually all of our work, always begins with listening. We begin listening internally in our congregation, and then we listen out through our other institutions, and then even beyond those institutions into the community. So hopefully when we arrive at a decision like calling for the resignation of a police commissioner, which BILD has only done once in its 37-year history, there has been consistent listening, and we're moving together as an organization. So I think that's important, that people are on the same page, that those kind of relationships are intact and strong. But there are times when, BILD will do something as an organization that I'm currently serving as co-chair, where some of my congregants will feel differently. And there's also room for diversity and difference within that.
And Rabbi Berg, you're also very involved in the neighborhood. Beth Am is a very involved fundamental institution in the neighborhood of Reservoir Hill, which I certainly know from personal experience living across the street. You and Andrew, for example, were very involved in advocating for passage of the same-sex marriage legislation that was successful here in Maryland. And we should make a distinction. You will welcome an interfaith couple, interfaith family to your congregation. You support same-sex marriage, but you won't perform weddings of interfaith same-sex couples, right?
Well, I don't discriminate. I also won't perform weddings of different sex couples who are not of the same faith.
Right.
This isn't that. That's a particular of the conservative movement and conservative rabbis. For me, it's less about whether I officiate at weddings and more about our posture toward those who would like to affiliate. You know, in the past, it was all about how do we draw boundaries and defend those borders. And now it's about honoring, I think, what are really permeable or semi-permeable membranes. Identity is much more fluid these days. And we want to celebrate people who have made that choice to come to the congregation, whether it's a choice to raise their children Jewish or whether it's individuals who are of various demographics, LGBTQ members of the community, Jews of color, Jews by choice, and so on and so forth.
Nearly 40% of folks are marrying or are marrying religiously intermixed. Religious intermarriage is up 40% now. It's twice what it was in marriages that happened before 1960. So this is a trend, certainly. And in the Northeast, people who are calling themselves non-affiliated is up some 25%. So both of you guys have experienced huge increases in the memberships of your particular congregations. Andrew Foster Conners, how do you, to what do you attribute that? You're bucking a big trend.
Well, that's a great question. I think there are several things. Number one is that the marketplace of ideas that you just, I think, eloquently described is actually, from my perspective, a huge opportunity for the Christian faith because it resituates us back in the position of the early church when the church didn't first think of itself as allied with the powers and authorities that be, but thought of itself as a liberating message to take to the world. So I think when we think of ourselves that way and not rest on our laurels or our history or a lot of the institutional accoutrements that we've brought forward, I think there's real power in that. And the second thing I would say is that the open, welcoming community that you described, I think people are hungry for that. People who've grown up Christian are hungry for that. People who are looking for a deeper sense of spirituality are hungry for a community that embodies the kind of message that it speaks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we haven't been ashamed of hanging out the rainbow flag and some other things to say we welcome all. And I think people are attracted to that.
And Daniel Berg, a lot of people attribute the increase in the congregation at Beth Am to your own personal charisma and your leadership. But it sounds to me like you're doing a pretty good job of walking that tightrope between inclusion and being welcome, but also, you know, adhering to the traditions of the faith.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how much of this is me versus what was really in motion long before I arrived. We have the great benefit at Beth Am of being a dynamic, growing Jewish congregation in a majority African-American neighborhood. And what that has allowed us to do is to really double down on our larger community. And so what we try to do with Beth Am and also through a nonprofit that we launched about a year or so ago is to be both in and for the community, but also of the neighborhood. How do we see ourselves as simply a part of this neighborhood? And then what sort of alliances and mutual understanding can we build through that work? That's really what Beth Am is about. So it's about honoring both the particularity that we represent, the integrity of our own Jewish tradition, textual heritage, but also understanding that we exist in a larger framework as part of a bigger world, a bigger neighborhood, a bigger city of Baltimore.
All right. Well, it's great to have both of you in this morning. And, of course, I will be seeing you around.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to have you both.
Thanks
here.
For having us.
The Reverend Andrew Foster Conners is the senior pastor of Brown Memorial Park Avenue Presbyterian Church in Bolton Hill. He's also the co-chair of BUILD, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. Rabbi Daniel Kotzenberg is the rabbi of Beth Am Congregation in Reservoir Hill. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. You've been listening to the latest installment in our series, Living Questions, produced by WIPR in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies, examining the role of religion in the public sphere. You can hear this and other conversations in our Living Questions series when you visit our website, wipr.org/livingquestions. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up on Maryland Morning. Stay with us. And as we do every Monday, we're checking with our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. Hey, Judy, how you doing?
Fine, thank you, Tom.
So you have been to see Thoroughly Modern Millie. It's at Cockpit in Court on the Essex campus of the Community College of Baltimore County. This is adopted from a 1967 movie. I have a vague recollection of the movie. it does have kind of a weird plot. Remind us what it is.
It does have a weird plot. It was a movie directed by George Roy Hill, and it had an all-star cast, Julie Andrews, Mary Tyler Moore, Carol Channing. It was Beatrice Lilly's last movie. And this strange plot, it was supposed to be a spoof on the 1920s. Millie comes to New York from Kansas, and she bobs her hair, and she wears flapper dresses, and she is determined to be a modern woman. But she thinks the way to do this is to marry a rich man, preferably her boss. So it's not the most feminist outlook, even when love triumphs in the end. I don't think I'm giving too much away there. But the oddest aspect is a subplot about, get this, white slavery. Yes, human trafficking. The woman who runs the boarding house where Millie is staying also runs a white slavery ring, and she poses for some reason as a Chinese woman, and she speaks in this real cartoon-style accent. So the show is also fairly politically incorrect. But odd as it is, Cockpit in Court has done a really lively, vibrant job. It's directed by Jimmy Kinsel. And if you can put aside the show's, let's say, somewhat distasteful plot elements, it's a slick, enjoyable production.
Interesting. That I didn't remember any of the plot, and I can see why. That just sounds wacky. And this movie was a musical, as I recall.
Yes.
In the stage show, do they just sort of sing the songs from the movie?
Well, no. I'm glad to say that the biggest difference between the movie and the stage show is that it has a new score. The score, in fact, won the 2002 Tony Award, as did the whole show. It was kind of a lean year. It does feature a few of the songs that were in the movie, which were mainly vintage songs. Victor Herbert's Ah, Sweet Mystery of Life is in there, and of course the title song, which was written for the movie. But about two-thirds of the score is new, and the lyrics are by Dick Scanlon, who's a Baltimore native. The stage show was his idea. He went to the screenwriter of the movie, Richard Morris, and suggested this, and then they co-wrote the script. The music, Tom, is by a real favorite of mine, Janine Tesori. She just won.
Oh, yeah. I like her a lot.
Yeah, she just won the 2015 Tony for Fun Home, which I went to see and enjoyed very much. Very talented composer.
She also did the one about the washing machines.
She did Caroline or Change, right. Absolutely. She has a real gift for writing music that fits the period, the sound of a particular show. And so here, her music has an authentic-sounding 20s feel to it. And the band at Cockpit is directed by someone named Patricia DeLisle. And this is one of the best bands I've ever heard there. They have a real jazzy sound. So I brought the opening number from the show, which will let you hear the band and the period sound, and the big voice of the leading lady at Cockpit, whose name is Amy Lucci, and she plays Millie.
Days of yore, kind and gentle, ask me if I'm sentimental, not for the life of me.
So there's Amy Lucci singing Not for the Life of Me from Cockpit in Court's production of Thoroughly Modern Millie. She sounds like a really strong singer. The band is good, and so is she. How about the rest of the cast?
Well, Lucci is strong, and her delivery of a song called Gimme Gimme near the end of the second act stopped the show on opening night. I'm afraid I didn't feel much chemistry between her and her leading man, who's played by Jim Baxter. Part of the problem may be that his delivery is so fast that I missed a bunch of his words. But most of the cast is strong. Most of the cast does a pretty impressive job. The best voice belongs to Nancy Parrish Azendorf. She plays the Carol Channing role, a diva with a heart of gold. So let's listen to her big number in the first act.
Please make that wish and seek that thrill. Come and get it, 'cause you always will. Strike up the band, only in New York.
And it's Only in New York. From Thoroughly Modern Millie in the production at Cockpit in Court. Now, we've talked about this a million times. You've always said that if a musical is adapted from an existing source, the musical should improve the source. So this is adapted from the movie. Does this stage version of Thoroughly Modern Millie improve on the movie?
Well, you would hope that it does improve on that strange movie, and yes, it does. It tightens the plot. It is still a very silly story with some fairly unpleasant aspects to it, but Cockpit has put together this really splashy, kicky show. The choreography is by Julie Foley, and it's really breezy and well-synchronized, everything from tap to Charleston. There are tons of period costumes, flapper dresses. The sets have this Art Deco look to them. And really, Tom, how much can I fault a show that not only has a reference to Cockeysville, Maryland, and yes, that is in the Broadway script, I checked, but it also has this great lyric, Aphrodite, don't forget me, Romeo and Juliet me.
All right. All is forgiven then for the rest, just on the basis of that line. All right. Thoroughly Modern Millie is at Cockpit in Court. Again, it's on the Essex campus of the Community College of Baltimore County. It's there until Sunday. We've got information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick, always a pleasure. We'll see you next Monday.
See you then.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Stick around.
Break the lock. Post my bail, done my time, I'm out of jail. Not for the life of me. A life that's gotta be more than a one-light town where the light is always red. Gotta be more than an old ghost town where the ghost ain't
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. One out of four Baltimore residents lives in a food desert, a low-income area that lacks access to fresh food from supermarkets. At the same time, the Maryland Food Center Authority estimates that half of what's in the Baltimore landfills is food waste, and it's estimated that includes millions of pounds of produce that could still be eaten. Each year, the Able Foundation gives an award to students who best analyze a critical issue facing the city and propose feasible solutions. The 2015 Able Award for Urban Planning goes to a paper that proposes a new vendor market in the heart of the city, where unsold wholesale food that would otherwise be tossed into landfills could be sold by small businesses at deeply discounted prices. So this winning paper suggests a solution both to food insecurity in food deserts and to excess food waste in Baltimore. Its authors join me in the studio. Marie Spiker is a doctoral student in human nutrition in the Department of International Health in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And her husband, Corbin Cunningham, a PhD candidate at the Johns Hopkins University Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, focuses on attention and perception. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
What are you proposing as a solution to this double-edged problem?
Yeah, so we're proposing the creation of a vendor's market, which some people might ask, how is that different than a farmer's market or something like that? And a vendor's market is just, it probably has the same feel as a farmer's market, only the food is coming from a wholesale institution like the MFCA. And so we're proposing the creation of that with a variety of vendors who would run the stalls, and just being able to use that food that might, end up getting thrown away or wasted, being able to sell that to individuals. And that food is still good as well.
Right. And so you asked exactly what we are proposing. And the ABLE Award seeks policy papers that propose policy solutions. And so what we proposed specifically was for the city to form a partnership with the Maryland Food Center Authority to support the creation of a vendor's market, for them to make sure that policies are in place to streamline the permitting process for vendors to become part of the vendor's market. And then third, for the city to help the vendor's market navigate the policies surrounding composting. Because one of our goals was that, so if you have a vendor's market and the food that doesn't get sold gets sent to the landfill anyways, then we're back where we started. So one of our goals is that if the food that gets unsold from the vendor's market could also be composted, this could be really efficient. However, composting in urban areas, while it's a great idea, is notoriously difficult, and the city could play a role in helping the vendor's market to navigate that regulatory process.
So composting is part of your answer.
Yeah, and so that food, basically any of the food that would normally just end up in the landfill, either a portion of it is going to get sold and hopefully eaten and consumed and things like that, and then anything else that would be left over, we could send to compost. And so essentially we're kind of blocking anything that would go to the landfill that could be used, and it's either going to be used directly or it can be used as kind of this alternative like compost or something like that in local gardens or even in maybe bigger farms surrounding the area.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with two doctoral students at Johns Hopkins. Corbin Cunningham is in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, and Marie Spiker is in the Department of International Health at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. We're talking about a paper they wrote proposing a way to put food that would otherwise be wasted into the kitchens of people who need it. What do you think it would cost to set up a vendor's market in Baltimore?
That's a great question. So there would be the issue of space. So where would it be hosted? There are existing spaces where there may not be any additional costs that would be incurred. The vendors would be operating independently. They would probably be part of a vendors association, mm-hmm. so there may be some cost there. But otherwise, it is a fairly low cost operation, other than potentially if there were a composting facility involved, that could be fairly costly. But for the operation of the vendors market itself, the cost would probably be comparable to what you might see for something like a farmer's market.
Yeah.
What are the potential drawbacks
sometimes people find that creating compost is difficult, where, you know, some people don't want it in their neighborhoods or things like that, or there's, you know, doing something like on-site in a small neighborhood might be difficult. And so while that seems like a potential drawback, there is a nice benefit of having that compost. So one of the things that we talk a little bit about in the paper is, you know, when that's created, there are some, I guess, like, unwanted issues with creating compost. And so people, you know, suggest like there's like a smell and things like that, as with all like organic product. But the benefit is that we're changing the course of where that potential waste would go from just sitting in a landfill to actually being used in a farm or being used in a garden or something like that, which seems like a pretty good alternative.
And one thing that I think maybe is not a drawback but a challenge, I think the biggest challenge would be for the vendors to be able to strike a balance between the quality and the price of the produce. Now, these are the mostly seconds and thirds, which means that it's produce that the wholesalers weren't able to sell to supermarkets, restaurants, and retailers that otherwise would have been sent to the landfill. So it's mostly seconds and thirds, but it's still at a quality that you would want to purchase it and you would want to consume it. And then the other piece to that is that it's incredibly inexpensive. So the prices are things like 10 limes for a dollar, 5 apples for a dollar, $4 for a box of tomatoes, $5 for a box of mangoes. So significantly cheaper than anything that you would be able to find in a supermarket. It's cheaper because you know that this wasn't all the number one graded produce, but still they've selected the produce that you would still be happy to purchase and consume it.
Big quote blown up in the report, haggling is encouraged.
Yes.
Why?
So one of the goals of the vendors there is to hopefully not send anything to compost or wherever it's going to go after trying to be sold. And so although, you know, getting, maybe undercut on a particular price for apples or something like that might not be ideal, it's better than getting no money for that particular product. And so because this is kind of a fast-paced environment where people are selling produce that needs to go today, they'll be able to say, oh, okay, well, instead of a dollar, maybe, you know, 50 cents for this apple or something like that. And so it's better than getting, no money for that particular item.
One of your points is that the availability of cheaper fruits and vegetables has an impact on purchasing and eating habits. What's the research on that?
Right. So a lot of the research shows that if you were to change the price of fruits and vegetables, if you were to decrease the price by maybe 10%, you might see an increase in demand, an increase in purchasing by maybe 4 or 5%. It wouldn't surpass, the increase in purchasing might not go beyond 10%. So they would say that the price for fruits and vegetables, the demand isn't elastic. But the decrease in price that we might see at a place like Haymarket is more than 10%. What we might see is something upwards of 50%. So it's a fairly substantial decrease. So the literature on whether the price decreasing the price of fruits and vegetables will increase consumption, the literature there isn't super, super strong, but I think it's because the margins in which they're playing, something like a 10% discount that you might see in a supermarket, these don't reflect the deeper discounts that you might be able to find at something like a vendor's market.
Let me try to translate that.
Sure.
You're saying that because there's potentially deep discounts in the prices of these fruits and vegetables, you might really improve people's diets. They might actually really buy a lot more fruits and vegetables and eat them.
Absolutely.
Right. Because if you were to decrease the price of fruits and vegetables by just a few cents, that might not be noticeable enough for people to want to buy more. But if this is something that's a fraction of the price that it usually is, you might be more likely to buy it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Marie Spiker, in the Department of International Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and her husband Corbin Cunningham in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, are winners of the 2015 ABLE Award for Urban Planning. Their paper suggests a vendor market in Baltimore. They will receive a $5,000 award. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning is an original production of
Your Public Radio,
WYPR in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1863, Brigadier General William Birney continued his energetic and some say illegal efforts to enlist African Americans in the Union Army by freeing 59 men from a slave pen in Baltimore and enrolling them in the U.S. Colored Troops. We're back on Wednesday. Please join us.